Nothing like some good Grinch action to get into a Christmas series. How are you guys doing tonight? It is so good to be here this evening as we continue our series, stepping into the land of Whoville. Timeless Christmas classic, right? In all of its like 45 different versions now of Grinch retelling. So growing up, I always thought that song that they sang was Ba Who Dor Us. Did anybody else have something different that they thought it was as a kid? I would imagine you probably did. We actually have the lyrics. If you're online, you can Google the lyrics. If you're here in person in the lobby, we actually have the lyrics on the thing. And it's like, I don't even remember. It's like Fa Who Rhombus, and you're like, what? That doesn't even make sense, because that's definitely not how I sang it as a kid. But nonetheless, we started off last week with that song where the people of Whoville are gathering together, singing out in excitement that the season of Christmas is upon us, and they sing the song, Welcome Christmas, Welcome, Welcome. It's the beauty of expectancy for the arrival of Christmas. And for those of us who are a part of the family of God, it is more than just the trappings of Christmas. It is more than even just the beauty of an opportunity for our family to get together. It's a moment for us to not just look for the arrival of a holiday, but to have this anticipation building, this remembrance of the past, this looking forward in the future of the beauty of God's plan of redemption continuing to unfold in our world. And we see it in its beauty, the gospel, better than any Christmas tree. We hear it in praises, and it's better than any communal song. But now in this particular view into the Grinch, into this story, we get to see how the one that was known as the Grinch processes that moment. Because if you were one of the Who's down in Whoville, this is a wonderful moment. We're all gathering together. We're singing as the tree is getting put up in the middle of the town. It's beautiful. But for the Grinch, this is bad news. He does not like it. There is nothing about this moment that he wants to be part of. That's why he calls it, just a little bit later in the clip, as he says that he gets an idea, a wonderful, awful idea. And when I was watching this short over the last few weeks in preparation for this series, that line stuck out to me, a wonderful, awful idea. And that stuck out to me because that could like be a bumper sticker for 2020, right? Like 2020, a wonderful, awful idea. And I don't know what your year has been like, but one of the things I've been realizing through this year is oftentimes, in each of our lives, we will have a year every once in a while where it's just a year. You guys know what I'm talking about? We're like, it's been a year. But rarely do we all go through the year together. We're like, are you having a year? Yeah, you, yeah, everyone. Everyone is having a year. We're just all having it a little bit in our own flavor, but all of us are like, it's a year. Allie and I were at Target the other day, and there was like the New Year's Eve, New Year's Eve headband, and it said best year ever, except the best was crossed out on it. And I was like, year ever. Yeah. Yeah. And it can seem like in every direction that the Grinch's plan, this idea that he has to steal Christmas, is like not just one day that's being stolen, but like our entire reality right now. Because I'm probably isn't a spoiler alert for you. You've probably seen this in some of its iterations at some point. But his wonderful, awful idea is to steal Christmas by putting on a Santa costume and going into Whoville and sucking up all of the presents and taking all the trappings and even taking the last can of Who Hash. Like, he is going all into this idea of stealing Christmas. So for us, it can feel like that is what's happening. Like all the proverbial presents are being snatched from under the tree. But if we are to continue on with this metaphor, then what we've been thinking about is then who is the Grinch in this scenario if we're being metaphorical about this? Now, in our last series in the book of Ephesians, we highlighted the reality of the brokenness that exists in this world, and that one of the major players, a major character in this, is a character known throughout the scriptures as the Satan. The Satan. You've heard about him in different iterations, sometimes called the devil, sometimes called Lucifer. But the Satan, now that word, Satan, it translates best into the word, the accuser. And that's an attribute that's used towards him in a number of different spaces. He is an accuser. He stands over like the Grinch does over Whoville. And he accuses God of cruelty and unfairness. He accuses humanity of half-truths, of outright lies, of false identities. This is why in the book of 1 Peter, Peter is writing and he says that the devil prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. This is why in the book of Ephesians, Paul is writing and he talks about that he is looking for someone to kill, steal, and destroy, which is why oftentimes when we talk about it, we say that Satan's goal is not to injure, to misplace, or to dishevel. Like, he is not, like, just trying to go, like, I'm just going to, like, mess with you just a tad. Like, no, like, he despises all of what God is doing in this world. And he wants to thwart it. He wants to destroy it. He wants to, in effect, like the Grinch, steal Christmas, God's plan of redemption. Now, we don't often think in terms of the spiritual. I would imagine that that has not been the primary thought as you are seeing what's happening in our political landscape, in spaces of racial injustice, in the pandemic, in all these different realities. You're probably not first going, man, what is the devil? What is the Satan, the accuser, desiring to do in this moment? I imagine it's probably not what we're doing. Because that's usually not what pops up on your Facebook feed, I would imagine, right? Now, I'm not going, a few weeks ago, Dave was up here in the book of Ephesians, and he talked about the spiritual realities of our world. And I'm not going to rehash a lot of what he said. Instead, I would encourage you to listen to that on our podcast. It was a really good message. But what I do want to do is go into a place that you may not have ever been to for a retelling of the Christmas story. Y'all, we're going into the book of Revelation tonight. So go ahead and open up your Bibles to Revelation 12. If that is not where you thought we were going to go, what we're going to see in Revelation 12 tonight is what I have been describing as a cosmic primer coat. Here's what I mean by that. Because this is a retelling of the story of the birth of Jesus from the cosmic perspective of what the enemy has been trying to affect in the story of God's plan of redemption throughout history, including what happened on that night 2,000 years ago when Mary and Joseph birthed a child. That reality is being talked into, and it provides a strong foundation, also in a background for a fully informed biblical understanding of not what just happened 2,000 years ago, but what's happening today. Because here's one thing that's worth knowing about the enemy. He's not original. He's not that crafty. He's not that cunning. He recycles over and over and over again. So we're going to look into this tonight. So when you think about Christmas, your first thought probably is, if you are familiar with the Bible at all, it is probably not to go towards the book of Revelation. And there's many reasons for that, I would imagine. Oftentimes, it's just because it's really, 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 really confusing. And yes, it is. But there is so much beauty in the unfolding narrative that what I want you to see tonight is that this quote unquote wonderful, awful idea of the accuser is the same one 2,000 years ago, 6,000 years ago, today. He wants to thwart God's story of redemption. Now, it's so crucial that we understand what his wonderful, awful idea is, because his scheme, the scheme of the accuser, has always been to eradicate our ability to trust in the finished work of Jesus. He wants us to question that Jesus isn't strong enough, that he's not good enough, that he doesn't care enough, that he is not with us in the midst of it. That God's compassion, that his love, that his greatness, that his goodness, that his sovereignty is all in question and all up for grabs. So the question that we need to ask tonight is, can any awful idea actually throw off God's story of redemption? Is Jesus beatable? Now, in essence, if we're putting it back into the land of Whoville, it's can the Grinch steal Christmas, basically, right? So let's go ahead and jump into this in Revelation 12, verses 1 through 4. And what we're going to be focusing on is the three characters in this passage. So I want you to see if you can identify them for yourself. And a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun,
with the moon under her feet, and on her head was a crown of 12 stars. She was pregnant, and she was crying out in birth pains in the agony of giving birth. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his heads, 7 diadems. His tail swept down 1/3 of the stars of heaven and cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that, don't miss this, so that when she bore her child, he might devour it. Merry Christmas, everyone. Now, if all of this seems so weird to you, or if that's difficult to understand, don't worry. That's what it's meant to do. That's the type of genre that this version of literature is called is apocalyptic literature. And it is intentionally confusing. It is intentionally meant to be layered like a good tiramisu or bean dip, where it's like just layered upon layers of different types of literary devices, metaphors, analogies, symbolisms, cultural context, hyperlinks back to other parts of the scriptures. And all of it is supposed to just be unfolding layer and layer and layer of prophetic beauty, but also stuff that's weighty, stuff that is supposed to captivate our minds, make us go, what could that possibly mean? Now, we're not going to get into all of it tonight, so don't worry about that. But there are those 3 main characters I want us to focus on tonight, because within this, there is these beautiful symbols of the woman and the child. And there's the terrible image of this red dragon. And these 3 characters are vitally important for us to understand if we are to understand our place in this world. Now, oftentimes symbols within apocalyptic literature has multiple layers of meaning. As in, it means one thing when you look back in the past, one thing in the present, and one thing in the future, or a blending of the 3. And those are all things that are important for us to get, because I don't want us to get bogged down in all of the minutiae, but instead be captivated by the characters in the story, because what we're going to see is the awful plan of the accuser. So the story starts out in verse 1. It starts with the woman, right? This pregnant woman, that she is a woman with a crown of 12 stars on her head. And that lets us know a little bit about what she is meant to symbolize. She is meant to symbolize the covenant family of God. Namely, in ancient times, that was pointing to the people of Israel, that out of the nation of Israel would come a child. Now, we get that because of the 12 stars on her crown. And anytime you see the number 12 within the scriptures, it is an allusion in some way to the nation of Israel because of the 12 tribes of Israel. Now, all of that's important because this was the promised nation by which the Messiah, the anointed one, the child that's being referred to here, is meant to unfold. The one who will unfold God's plan of redemption. Emmanuel, God with us. The Prince of Peace. Mighty God. The Counselor. That God, that one, would come in the form of a child. And there would be birth pains that would be associated with this. And that's what it says in this passage, which is an allusion to Micah 4, where in Micah 4, it talks about this time of anticipation and arrival, where it's like everyone is groaning like a woman that is about to give birth, waiting for this moment where the Messiah would come. But it's a good expectation. It's like, he's coming. He's not leaving us forever. Good news is coming. But there's one. That's like the image down in Whoville, right? But then you got the Grinch up on the mount. And he doesn't see the image the same way. What does the red dragon do? The red dragon, he symbolizes Satan, the devil. And he wants to do one thing. And this is what we need to know about him more than anything else. He has one goal, and is to devour the child. That's it. He wants to devour the child. He wants to destroy whatever this child is. He wants to destroy God's plan of redemption from being enacted and unfolding. That is his truest desire. See, again, he's not creative. He's not innovative. He has one play in his game book, and it is devour the child. Now, where does this come from? Just like in the live action version of How the Grinch Stole Christmas, where you get a little bit of the background onto where this story came from for the Grinch. Like, why does he want to steal Christmas in the first place? And they give him that backstory, right? Because he's this incredibly strong bearded toddler and people are really mean to him. And he's like, I hate Christmas. And he throws that Christmas tree. And then that one woman is like, as a child, is like super impressed by it. And like, it's like, whoa. And anyway, so you have that background story, right? Now, in the book of Genesis, we find out the origins for where the accuser's desire comes from to devour the child. Now, in the beginning, God created everything to be harmonious and beautiful. And then within the beautiful creation of the cosmos, he created mankind. He created man and woman to image him, to be these image bearers to the world, to demonstrate love, to demonstrate life, to demonstrate true freedom, to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. That was it. But the accuser takes the form of a serpent. And he attempts to throw off God's plan of redemption by getting mankind to rebel, by simply asking him to do one thing and one thing only, to seek after the fruit from the knowledge of good and evil. In other words, to define good and evil on their own terms. And guys, isn't that what we all do now? Isn't that still the most broken desire within us, is when we want to define good and evil on our own terms? This is why all of us, even those of us who are in the family of God, can from time to time go, but is that really what God meant when he said that? Because that's exactly what the serpent said to them. Is that really what God said? And the temptation works. Man and woman rebel against their wonderful creator. And in that, brokenness ensues throughout the cosmos. Death rages into the story. Now, at that point, the accuser always wanted to throw off God's plan. But his plan, there wasn't a need at that moment yet for a redemption. Because everything was working in unity, in harmony. But now, something new was coming, and he thought, man, I threw it off. Yes. Then in Genesis 3, what we discover is that God promises that one day a child will come, a descendant of the woman, who will come and do one thing, crush the head of the serpent. The serpent crusher would come. Now, if you're the serpent, what do you hear in that? I need to vanquish the child. So when we get that reference back in Revelation 12, this is a hyperlink back to this moment. The plan has always been the same. His plan is not creative. It is simply devour the child. And we see that as a consistent theme throughout the Old and into the New Testament through the Gospels. And for example, at the earliest part, right after this moment when they were expelled from the garden, they have two sons. Adam and Eve have two sons, Cain and Abel. Abel is righteous. He desires to delight in the Lord. He desires to live a life of sacrifice to God. And everything was meant to be beautiful in his life. But his brother Cain is jealous. So Cain murders his brother. Out of temptation, he murders his brother. So the righteous one is dead. The unrighteous one is alive. Neither is going to be a serpent crusher today. But Eve bears another son. His name's Seth. And it's through Seth that the expanse of the globe continues on. The lineage from Adam all the way through to Jesus ensues. So the serpent crusher is still in effect. Now, let's fast forward a few more many generations, and corruption has happened all across the world. The enemy has tempted humanity, and the brokenness within humanity has come to such a point where it's described that every thought and intention of man became evil. And this is when God allowed disorder to come back into his world of order, and the flood ensues all of the globe. And if you're the enemy, you're like, sweet, no more humans, except Noah. Noah and his descendants, they make it out. God preserves humanity through them. Generations go by, and we discover through prophecy, a prophecy that's relayed to a guy named Abraham and to his wife Sarah, that they would have a descendant who would bless all the nations of the world. This kid would come through their lineage. And they become, and through their descendants, become the nation of Israel. And that's when the enemy desires to stop the covenant family from thriving to bear this child. We see it in the temptations against Abraham and Sarah to not trust the faithfulness and patience in God, all the way through to when the people of Israel find themselves enslaved in Egypt. And they're enslaved in Egypt, and what is happening? They are enslaved, and they are being squashed down and pushed down because Pharaoh has a hard heart, and his heart only gets more and more hardened. But even still, God raises up Moses to be the rescuer, to preserve the people of Israel, and to lead them into spaces of freedom. Even when the nation of Israel remains unfaithful, even when they turn so quickly to other gods, God is faithful when we are faithless. Generations go by, and we find out that there is a guy named David, a young shepherd boy who's anointed with oil that he would become the king. And not only that, later on in his story, we find out that it is through his lineage that this child would be born. And we see throughout the story of David, temptation after temptation after temptation, death threats, people coming after him to kill him over and over and over again, him falling into weakness and brokenness, committing adultery, having that woman's husband murdered, all of this brokenness, and still God's faithfulness is still covering his people. Even though he is so broken, even though he gets it wrong, God still gets it right. He isn't thwarted because the enemy has an awful idea. He's not confused by it. He's not surprised by it. Generations go by, and the nation of Israel is now going into a state of decay. Because they have pursued other gods, because they have pursued alliances with foreign powers, they are now in a space of brokenness. And they, in this brokenness, God ends up allowing them to experience the natural consequences of their actions. And they are invaded by foreign powers. And eventually, even, they're carted off to the corners of the globe, and a remnant is found in the nation of Persia, where King Artaxerxes is over the nation, and a man, one of his advisors, named Haman. Haman tempts him, saying, "These Israelites, they're bad news for your nation." And he convinces him to call for a genocide of the entire people of Israel. That's a pretty good way to devour the child. Make sure that there's no one left in that family to be able to birth a child. But yet, what does God do? He had placed the wife of Artaxerxes to be a woman named Esther. Now, Esther is brilliant. She is bold. She is brave. And she goes to her husband because she's an Israelite. She's Jewish. So she goes and she stands in the gap on behalf of her people. And she proclaims and convinces the king, even though she could have died for this, she goes and convinces the king to not only allow them to survive, but allow them to begin to thrive once again. Guys, this is constantly God's story of redemption being enacted in a broken and fallen world, that the awful idea of the enemy can't actually thwart what God's up to. God's plan, it wins. It can't be thrown off. Which is why a few hundred years later, the child is born. On a night in Bethlehem that probably wasn't in December, a child is born. A child is born. The creator of the cosmos, the word of God incarnate, takes on human flesh. Think about that. The one who deserves nothing but praise and glory and honor is found in a manger wrapped in swaddling cloths. He's cold. He needs warmth. He is vulnerable in the way that any baby is vulnerable. And you know, what's so interesting about the accuser is he doesn't attack, and if you look even at the stories I just mentioned, he doesn't attack in strength, right? In our moments of strength and our moments when we are drawing near to Jesus, where does he attack? He attacks in our weakest moments. And for Jesus, in the life of Jesus, the first time he attacks is he tries to attack Jesus at birth. And he does that by tempting King Herod, who is this puppet king of the people of Israel. And he tempts him to go because this Messiah has been born theoretically. So he goes and he orders the mass execution of all the children under the age of 3. It says, go and kill all of them. Devour the child. The same story still in effect. But God prompts Mary and Joseph to take Jesus and they escape into the wilderness and he survives. The next showing where the enemy comes back in the story in Jesus' life is when Jesus is about 30 years later starting his earthly ministry. And he goes, before he goes on his ministry trek, he goes into the desert. And he goes to pray and to fast for 40 days and 40 nights. And and for any human, we can't do that very well at all. For Jesus, he's God, so that works out well for him. But still, I would imagine he's hungry. And we could imagine that because what does the accuser tempt him with? With food. He tempts him with a bunch of different things that would make him seek the passions of the flesh and his own personal desires. But he combats the enemy. He can't lose. He can't be devoured or thrown off. A few years go by and Jesus is in the Garden of Gethsemane. And we can see the anguish and the pain that he is going through, the temptation that he is experiencing. But at the end of it, when he is bleeding droplets of blood, he prays, God, but not my will, but your will be done, my Father. The enemy cannot win. And even though for Jesus, that would call for him to be tortured, to be humiliated, to be mocked and scorned, for him to be able to forgive while hanging on a cross, taking our brokenness, the brokenness of the world, onto himself and drawing his last breath. And if you're the enemy, what do you think then? It's over now. It's over. It's over. But Jesus makes a mockery of death and the accuser when he raises on the third day from the grave. And guys, that is good news. I don't always believe that's good news. I believe that's like decent news or something. Like, I don't truly believe how incredible that news is. The accuser has been made a mockery of. He has no power. He has nothing except one lame trick in his playbook, except one scheme, and it doesn't work very well. And then Jesus goes to the right hand of the Father, and this is what we get in verse 5. She gave birth to a male child. He wanted to devour the child. Didn't work. The birth happened. She gave birth to a male child. Who is this child? One who's to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. But her child was caught up to God and to his throne. That passage literally is the entire story of Jesus' life. From birth all the way to enthronement, which is where Jesus sits now at the right hand of the Father, waiting in the time of his second arrival when he'll come to make all things new. So are you seeing how this same awful idea that can never accomplish what it's set out to do? Are you seeing this? And even when we humans, we play a part too. This isn't just Satan. We play a part in this. We rebel against our good creator. When we rebel against our desire for true flourishing, when we reject him in our words, our thought, and our actions, when we find our voice among the scoffers that are hurling insults at Jesus. You see, even in our worst, nothing can throw off God's plan of redemption. Verse 6, and the woman fled into the wilderness where she has a place prepared by God in which she is to be nourished for 1,260 days. See, Jesus is meant to rule. Jesus is meant to rule, and the awful accusations, the awful plans of the accuser can't stop it, can't step in. Jesus is enthroned at the right hand of the Father, and that is such incredibly powerful news. But the question is, we know where Jesus is at, but where are we at in this story? Where's the church at in this? Well, you see, the woman continues to represent the covenant family of God. But what we discover is that throughout the scriptures, the covenant family of God has been redefined to not just include the ethnic people group of the Jewish people anymore. It has been expanded into a spiritual family, a family embodied by the Spirit of God, marked by Him, not just an ethnic people group. And by the way, sidebar, this is why the church, despite its many flaws, is the most ethnically diverse spiritual movement to ever occur in the history of the world. See, there's such a beauty in the diversity of the family of God, which is what we see throughout the story of Revelation when the nations come with all praise and glory and honor to the Father forever and ever. So who is this woman? The family of God, the church. The church is now in this story. The woman is fleeing into the wilderness because the church remains here on planet Death, right? That's where we sit. Where the awful ideas of the accuser, they're still enacted. But does that mean that the accuser has all right, all authority? No. See, God is still in control. And even when our path looks difficult, even when our circumstances are really, really, really terrible, we know who still is in control. At least we can. See, God's ongoing story of redemption can't be interrupted by any wonderful, awful idea. In verse 17, we get to see the way that this kind of plays out. Then the dragon became furious with the woman. And he lost his chance at the child. So what's he going to do next? So he went off to make war on the rest of her offspring, which if you are in the family of God, that's you. Sorry, I don't know if that's really scary. Probably it should be more scary for me than it really is. But here's why this is good news. On those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. And he stood on the sand of the sea. It says earlier that the woman flees into the wilderness, but what happens to her? She is going into a place that's prepared by God. Even though the accuser is lashing out like a wounded animal. Even though he is trying to attack and to steal, kill, and destroy, we are in the family of God. And because we're in the family of God, we are protected. We are under the sovereign authority of the Father, marked by the Spirit, sealed because of the work of Jesus. And you see, this might all sound pretty intense, but here's the truth. His plan works just about as well as the Grinch's plan to steal Christmas. Let's go ahead and see what happens after he steals all the presents.
Poo-poo to the Who's, he was grinchily humming. They're finding out now that no Christmas is coming. They're just waking up. I know just what they'll do. Their mouths will hang open a minute or two, then the Who's down in Whoville will all cry, boo-hoo. That's a noise, grinned the Grinch, that I simply must hear. He paused, and the Grinch put a hand to his ear. And he did hear a sound rising over the snow. It started in low, then it started to grow. This sound wasn't sad. Why? This sound sounded glad. Every Who down in Whoville, the tall and the small, was singing without any presents at all. He hadn't stopped Christmas from coming. It came. Somehow or other, it came just the same.
it came all the same. It doesn't matter what the accuser attempts. Now, does that mean that we will never experience difficulty or hardship? No. That's not the story that God has allowed to be told through the family of God. In fact, shortly after Jesus ascended into the heavenly spaces, the persecution of the church began. Under emperors like Nero and Domitian, Nero famously burning down a third of his own of the city of Rome so that he could do an epic remodel, and blames it on the Christians and the Jews and begins the persecution of the church. Christians die in the Roman Colosseum, torn apart by wild beasts. Domitian enforcing emperor worship. And if you do not bow down to the idol of the emperor, then you can face death. And since then, Satan has continued his attacks on the remaining children of the woman throughout the story of the family of God over the last 2,000 years. We have seen it through divisions within the church as he attempts us towards that, those spaces, through spiritual and literal warfare, through things like racism and nationalism, through the distrust of the church and the hypocrisy of the church, through bad theology and heresy, through fake good news, fake gospel messages, through ongoing persecution, which, by the way, right now, there are more Christians in spaces of high persecution than any other time in the history of the world. There are 245 million Christians who find themselves in places of high persecution. 1 in 9 Christians right now find themselves in persecution. But yet the gates of hell shall not prevail against us. It doesn't matter what he does to try to steal it. It doesn't matter what he tries to do to devour us. Because even the worst he could do is take our lives. And what's brilliant in this story is we have this beautiful image when the family of God fights back and actually wins. Because right now it doesn't always feel like we win, right? But get this, verse 11, let's go back to this. And they, who's the they? The family of God, the descendants of this woman, us. And they have conquered him, the dragon. How? By the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. For they loved not their lives even unto death. We are not strong because we are so smart or cunning or strategic in our planning. We are strong because we have two tools in our tool belt. The blood of the Lamb. The beautiful message of the gospel. That reconciliation is not only possible, but it's already here and it is expanding. It is expanding hope, life, light, and freedom is here now through the blood of the Lamb, Jesus, and by the word of their testimony. So it's not just like I've intellectually believed the gospel, but I have been impacted by the life-transforming aptitude of the gospel. And now it is changing me and allowing me to love God and to love people in incredible new ways. And as we go, we stand against the forces of darkness with the weapons of the gospel, and the way that the gospel has impacted our lives and the message we now carry because of both of those realities. That's where we stand. That is our reality. See, the accuser might have an awful idea, but he doesn't have a wonderful one. But what Jesus had, it's not an awful truth. It is a beautiful, wonderful, captivating story. That we can have new life, that we can bring the kingdom here and now, and that one day he will come and he will make all things new. He will wipe away every tear from our eye. Disease will be no more. We won't be afraid of pandemics. We won't suffer anxiety and depression. We won't deal with any of the brokenness of this world and the xenophobia that happens within it. We will be known and we will truly know one another, and the accuser will be done. But until that moment, we find ourselves with the one who is good. And we can go with the blood of the Lamb and the word of the testimony. That we could go speak as a gospel voice with life, light, and freedom.
Now, I don't know what this year has looked like for you. You may have found yourself questioning just about everything about God, questioning his faithfulness, questioning his goodness, questioning God. How are you either like you took a break for a year, or do you just really not care? Because it seems like you're not present in the here and now. But here's the truth. God is present. And he is present because he sent the one who is presence, the one who is imminent, Jesus, to be incarnate, to be in person. And you see, he is the one who will rule all the nations with an iron scepter. He is the one who nothing can stand against him, that he cannot be devoured, that he cannot be beaten up against. He is the one that we stand with. And if we are with him, then we can rest in his embrace. No matter what this world throws at us, no matter what our circumstances are telling us, we know that there is a hope in the gospel that goes beyond circumstances and transforms current realities. And if we live in this, what I believe we will see is that the beautiful song that draws others near is like the song down in Whoville that's being sung by a choir together. But we are the song being proclaimed. We are the carriers. We are the beacons of hope. Drawing others near is we are telling people about the beauty of Jesus. I don't know if the gospel has been feeling like good news for you. But if that is the case, where you're like, man, I do believe the gospel, but I don't truly experience it as good news, I would love to pray for you. So I'm going to invite the band to come on up. And what I want you to do, if that is you, I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand or anything like that, but I am going to ask you to do something with your hands. I'm going to ask you to simply extend your hands in front of you. If the gospel has not felt like good news, if that's not been your experience, I would love to pray over you that you would be captivated again by your first love gospel, what Jesus is doing. So if that's you, just put your hands out in front of you in a posture of reception. Father, I thank you for the gospel, even when I am not thankful for the gospel. I thank you that it is good news, whether I'm feeling it or not. I thank you that nothing, that the accuser can't do anything to stand against it. That nothing can stand against us. Nothing can stand against you. That you are strong, that you are mighty to save, that you are abounding in faithfulness. That it is not based on us and our anything, but it is on you and what you are already doing. So Father, I pray for each of us right now that has had a weary heart this year. For those of us who have not felt like the gospel is good news. Lord, I pray for those of us who are online. I pray for those of us who are listening to this in a podcast. I pray for those of us who are here in person. Lord, would you draw us back to our first love? Would we repent of whatever is on in our hearts that is blocking us, whatever lies of the enemy we have been believing, whatever untruths that we have been calling true. Lord, I pray that you would captivate our hearts and our minds again, that you would bring a revival into this community, into the church in Orlando, Florida, and the church in the United States, and your church around the globe. We need you. We need to be captivated by you. But we don't have a testimony to tell if we are not receiving the gospel as good news. So Lord, I surrender tonight. And I pray for all of us that we would surrender to you tonight. Would you fill us with your spirit in a way that is fresh and new tonight? That he would speak the truth of the gospel on our lives, on our hearts, on our minds, on our spirits this evening, here, now. Come, Lord, your kids are listening. Thank you for the hope that we have in the gospel. Help us to believe. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.